Southern Oregon was once a hotbed of activity for white supremacists. It's easy to find pictures of Ku Klux Klan marches in Ashland and other cities in the 1920s. That was a very long time ago. But concerns linger that distrust, suspicion, and outright hatred of non-Anglo-Saxon groups continue in the region, with some evidence to support those concerns, like the appearance of what appear to be recruiting posters for white supremacist groups in places like Grants Pass. Let's talk about what has been seen and what the community response has been. Our guest is Bill Landis, who is the public safety chief in Grants Pass. Public safety because police and fire under one chief, and you are it. Chief Landis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Grants Pass does have some history of racism itself, but you've been there for some time. Does it seem to flare up from time to time in recent decades?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I can remember back 27 years ago in my career where we've had the same kind of recruiting or spike with groups that showed up, and they kind of came and went and didn't really stay.
What observations have you made about the kinds of conditions that may be going on either society or economically or anything else that indicate when you might see a flare-up of these?
Well, I think certainly across our country today, there's a lot of that going on, and Grants Pass not removed from any of that. And so several months ago, we had those posters start showing up, and of course, that can create quite a controversy in any community where one group is espousing their beliefs over another and creating, you know, potential conflicts that could be physical and other if those groups, you know, try to intimidate another group.
What kinds of posters were showing up? What sorts of things have shown up around Grants Pass in particular?
Well, the specific ones were basically recruiting for, you know, a neo-Nazi or white supremacist type group to increase their numbers, I guess you could say. And I don't like to get too specific because I don't like to give attention to different groups or, you know, their name or nomenclature, if you will. But it was enough that it certainly caused alarm in our community and people concerned about an uprising of a group like that that may, you know, espouse hate or intimidate other you know, citizens in our community.
Well, were swastikas showing up too? Do I understand that to be?
Yeah, there were swastikas and part of the picture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if people do call police for a response, I mean, what can you?
We certainly want to monitor groups that may be intimidating. You know, intimidation is a crime in the state of Oregon. Is a specific statute that basically is designed to protect one's race, color, religion, sexual orientation, disability, or national origin, and any person or persons who would want to intimidate somebody either by damaging property, harassing them, or causing some sort of physical harm is subject to misdemeanors and felony charges under those statutes. So anytime we see those posters, we certainly have concerns that potential of a crime that may be occurring or ongoing with these groups, and so we start to monitor that to make sure that that's not happening. And of course, the difficulty is free speech is alive and well in our country under the Constitution, and so protecting that is as important as also protecting groups that may be victimized by these kind of groups.
Oregon's free speech protections in particular are even somewhat broader than the America, the nationwide, aren't they?
I don't know that. I know that it's you know, certainly we have to be careful, and that's probably one of the difficult challenges of law enforcement is allowing those to speak what they feel at the same time inciting other people to, you know, violence and conflicts and what have you. And so it's been difficult for law enforcement to walk that fine line to protect both of those things.
When you talk about the crime of intimidation, though, does it have to be more or less a face-to-face kind of thing?
Not necessarily. It can actually even be third person or party. Like a poster could actually have specific language that, you know, could be, you know, construed as threatening or intimidating. So that's why free speech isn't just, you know, 100% alive and well. We certainly have to monitor what's being said and what the language is and whether someone's being threatening to another. And so those could constitute a crime.
Bill Landis is the public safety chief in Grants Pass. We're talking about the appearance of what appear to be white supremacist recruiting posters and other symbols around town. Maybe it's happened in your town as well. You join our conversation here on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I know you mentioned you didn't want to talk about the names of the groups, but True Cascadia is the group that appears in name on the poster. Is there any way of knowing A, anything about a group, and B, if in fact the poster is from that group and not another party pretending to be that group?
You know, that's a great question. A lot of these groups will operate under different names. And so they may be, you know, nationally known as one thing, and they can have spinoff groups in communities that basically operate under another name but are aligned with, you know, the larger group, if you will. So law enforcement really monitors that to see, you know, who's involved, whether that group is involved in some sort of violence that we should be concerned with, or it's an individual who poses as a group, maybe for whatever reason. So we certainly try to look into that and monitor that.
Is there any chance it's just a tactic to scare people? I mean, some of this did happen in October, and we were also seeing scary clowns showing up in some communities in October, too. And I just, you know, wonder if it's, if people are getting their jollies from throwing a scare into people when there's no actual intent behind it, or if there might, in fact, be some intent.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that's accurate. Over my the course of my career, we certainly had person or persons that weren't really affiliated with the group yet, you know, represented that they were. So that is something that, you know, we discover when we start looking into this.
All right. So we've already talked about free speech protections and how broad they are. And I mentioned that Oregon is a little broader because there are things like exotic dancing that come under the heading of free speech in Oregon. In America, you can say what you want with generally few limits. When are there particular actions that have to take place in order for it to cross the line from I'm just talking to I'm trying to achieve something with the speech, I'm trying to spur an action?
Yeah, generally that's where the crime of menacing comes into play. So for instance, I could speak what I feel and what I believe in, but if I start to basically menace somebody by placing them in imminent fear by my language or conduct, then that basically constitutes a crime in Oregon and a misdemeanor offense. So, you know, two people could be at a separate end of a bar and one person said, I'm going to come over there and, you know, beat you up. Different than if you're standing in front of them, you know, clenching your teeth and your fists and about ready to punch somebody. And certainly that places somebody in more imminent fear than just a statement, if you will. So, yeah, we look at that as a potential crime when you're looking at free speech issues.
It brings to mind some things that happened in Ashland a year ago or more. You know, people saying things like, you know, I can still get away with killing a black person in Oregon and not serve any jail time for it. Does that sound like a threat statement?
So the way you pose that, certainly that is, you know, alarming and certainly offensive, but constituting actual steps to carry out or to place somebody in imminent fear is where that line is probably not. So that's where free speech protects that individual, even though it's offensive to someone else.
All right. So lots of legal hoops to go through and protections for people to be able to say the things that are on their mind. Now, in Grants Pass, where the posters showed up, I mean, people have taken down some of the posters. Is that true?
Yeah, we also have municipal code that doesn't allow you to place posters or things on things such as telephone poles or light posts or things like that. So those immediately get taken down by our code enforcement officers. Garage sale signs get taken down. So when they start up trying to put these signs up and stuff, we immediately take them down under the municipal code, regardless of what the language or what they're, you know, stating.
All right, so it's not a content-based thing at all. It's just like you got it on a piece of public property, or in this case, the power company property, whatever the case, in the public right-of-way.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically how we take care of that.
Are there any cases in which, by law, you have to leave things up?
Boy, that's a great question. I don't know that because we certainly use the municipal code to, you know, control that. Otherwise, you know, you'd have all kinds of things stuck on posts and signs. And I think citizens in our community, at least, are very, you know, concerned about signage. I mean, there's even municipal code and development code that actually protects how big a sign can be placed even on a business. So certainly that's really how it's taken care of. And I don't know of an example where we have to leave something up on those utility poles and such.
If it's on private property, though, and the assent of the landowner is there, it seems like nobody's got any rights, though, to take those down.
Yeah, and actually what they do in Grants Pass, and I think other communities, is they actually control the size and whether or not engineering has to be done. So somebody wants to put a big 12x12 sign up, and certainly from a safety standpoint, the wind and what have you, you're actually required to have a permit to do that. So signs are pretty limited to smaller yard-type signs if you're on private property. It's when they hit a certain height or a certain size now you actually trigger permits and inspections to make sure the signs are safe.
What about signs and windows, things like that? It seems like if you're in the window of a private home, you can express whatever you want, really.
Correct. Yeah, private property, you certainly can.
Bill Landis is the public safety chief in Grants Pass. We're talking about the presence of white supremacist recruiting posters showing up in his town and a couple of others around the region as well. Maybe you have some stories to share about this with us. Join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So do you ever get to the point where you have to parse the wording of it and figure out if it is in fact offensive? How much analysis do you have to go through on the signs other than it's on it's on a public lamppost or something.
You know, sometimes we have to get cooperation. I'll give you an example. So I think it was summer before last, we had a Black Lives Matter protest, which brought out, you know, opposition and pretty much lines of demarcation to separate the groups. And some of the signs to one group was pretty offensive. And so I actually had to insert myself to ask for some cooperation to take a sign down that was going to basically incite people to riot or, you know, fight. And, you know, so sometimes I'm asking for cooperation, even though I may not have the authority, you know, to make that change with free speech issues. And so fortunately for us, we did get cooperation, and that has happened. So that does create our challenges when we're walking that fine line.
Well, that was the next set of questions then, was about concerns about when it goes beyond posters and gets into the cases where people are potentially demonstrating and then sometimes counter-demonstrating at the same time. I mean, you no doubt keep one eye on the news and can see things like in Portland in particular, where the people and not just the posters end up clashing in the streets sometimes. What kinds of preparations or intelligence or anything do you do to prep for that in Grants Pass?
Well, we certainly do look at intelligence and what we can learn about different groups and individuals who are involved. I certainly like to meet with the leadership of the groups beforehand so that I can ask for some cooperation. In the example that I gave, I asked for one group to be across the street from the other group, which kind of gave us, you know, if you will, a neutral zone to keep the groups separated, receive that cooperation, which I think helped the event go off without any major skirmishes or what have you. And then throughout the event, had to keep, you know, inserting myself into the different sides to make sure that they were controlling people who were becoming quite agitated and potentially going to be, you know, an issue. So meeting with leadership in advance, asking for some cooperation, being there and vigilant so that if something does start to happen, we're able to helpfully quell it before it becomes too large. Those are usually how you are more successful in those type of incidents.
It sounds like a fairly standard police response. I mean, in fact, I remember in Grants Pass many years ago when the former head of the National Organization for Women came and there was a counter-protest across the street, but it seems like that using the street, particularly a big one like 6th Street or 7th Street, helps to take your job a little easier.
Yes. In fact, in the example that I gave, I told the other group that, you know, you're just going to make the numbers look larger, and so maybe perhaps you want your group to be on the other side of the street, and I think they bought into that, so it worked well for us on that day.
Do you have to, I imagine there's a fair amount of having to keep a poker face, particularly as somebody who's trying to look, I'm just here to make sure that people have their rights and they get to exercise those and nobody gets hurt.
Correct.
And you can't, but you have to be able to talk to all sides in any particular dispute.
That is so critical. You know, my beliefs or my opinions are not part of what my job is. And so forming partnerships with the groups to let them know what my job is, what I'm there to do is very important, and that I take no sides or opinions about what it is they're trying to state or protest or what have you. And so that, in my opinion, leads to great success in these type of situations, so that they do feel like that you're impartial as you try to like navigate through what may be potential problems.
How much training down to the patrol level to handle situations like that? I mean, you appear well versed in it, but I just wonder how, you know, how much below the deputy chief level it gets, for example.
Yeah, at the line level, it's important. Just we teach tactics, if you will, from the supervisory level and up, basically controlling the event, managing the event, I guess you could say, so that all their leaders and supervisors are well versed in, you know, how to crowd control. And again, preparation is the key, as you talked about. Great question. You know, preparation is really how you're going to be successful in, when these things happen.
Is there something like a procedural manual, a playbook, if you will, for how to handle large groups of people who are fairly angry?
You know, there's a lot of training out there nowadays that law enforcement attends, and we use a you know, incident command model that we use for all major events. That helps us control anything, whether it's you know, a protest, a riot, if you will, or a major, you know, barricaded suspect subject, fires, large scale fires. Our incident command system and public safety as first responders is critical, no matter what it is you're managing.
Which raises the question: I mean, is there some cross training between police and fire? I mean, as public safety, you have both under your management. So how much cross-training is there from one side to the other to at least know what some of the basic practices are for the guys on the other side?
Yeah, our line-level people receive cross-training annually. Basically, we have police officers that can do fire size up, take a hydrant, do basic skills, if you will. And certainly our firefighters participate in searches and other things that we would need extra bodies for, if you will. Most of our cross-training happens at the command level, so our incident management team is well-versed in both fire and police, so we can better staff those events with, you know, different sets of eyes, if you will. So most of that's at the command level, not necessarily the line level.
Let's take a call. We have Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Landis, the Grants Pass Public Safety Chief. Hi, Wolfgang.
Hi there. Hi, Bill. And what I wanted to say is I've attended quite a few marches and protests and stuff, and I always see a very polite, competent presence of the Grants Pass police. These people are wonderful. They're there. You have a sense of they're not watching against this thing. Calm.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who want to give the finger and all that. But in my opinion, in my observation, in my experience, they're good. It just makes me feel good that they're there.
All right. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. So there's a vote of confidence.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. And that, the good news is that's our mission and that's our desire. So that's the bullseye we try to hit.
Is there always going to be in Grants Pass, and granted that the city is changing, I mean, it's growing quite a bit. It seems like one of the last refuges of fairly affordable housing in the Rogue Valley. So you're going to get some more diversity over the years. But I just wonder how much you have to be aware in police work of either a fairly consistent strain of white supremacy sorts of things or an undercurrent of resentment or something like that in the community.
Yeah, I think that I like to call it the public-private partnership. I think success in law enforcement comes when basically you are connected to your community and what's happening. I think certainly there's examples across our country where that wasn't happening, and so we saw the results when those two are not communicating in advance of a bad situation.
Like in Charlottesville, you mean?
Yeah, as one example. I mean, certainly many across our country. For me, that's exactly what has to happen. My bullseye or my target is really what the community needs and wants are, and so trying to meet that for the majority. Again, I can't meet everybody's needs, but certainly for the majority, what is it that I'm supposed to, provide as far as services and how do I meet those? And they are ever-changing. Our community's grown. I think when I started, we were 4.5 square miles. We're up to 11.5 and continue to grow and annex more of the urban growth boundary.
Well, so that's twice the area for your folks to patrol. I mean, I don't imagine you've doubled the number of officers over that time, have you?
Probably pretty close, and we certainly have added stations, so we could, our response times we have 4 public safety stations now. When I started, we had 2, so we've doubled those to make sure we can get to wherever we need to in a reasonable amount of time.
And when you say public safety station, that's police and firefighters in the same structure?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So that probably helps to have them together under one roof. You don't get the sense of rivalry that seems to show up in some bigger cities between police and fire departments.
Yeah, I think there's still some of that rivalry. Some of the things are pretty funny. But I think when it comes to providing the services out on the street, we're very aligned. We assimilate well, and our jobs are intertwined. So it is nice to have that camaraderie, too, especially when we're out there doing our job.
So back to the white supremacy moves and the recruiting posters showing up. It looks like members of the community have made some moves of their own, posting messages of tolerance and diversity downtown and trying to get some meetings and things like that. I mean, do you take part in that as Grants Pass Public Safety, or facilitate it in any way, or just sort of stand back and let things happen?
Yeah, I do take part, and I'm invited to many different of those type of events. We have town hall forums probably quarterly where people can come and speak their minds and talk about what their needs are, and certainly have me address some of those things and what we're doing if there's issues or concerns. And so I think that open dialogue is critical. Me being invited and attending those things are critical, so I can hear what the perceptions are or what the concerns are, and then that helps me apply services that we provide more effectively.
So what are some of the things, when you're there for questions, it seems like there are probably a few things that people have come away with thinking that are incorrect about what's going on in Grants Pass. Is there a particular myth that you need to bust more than any other when things like this begin to happen?
I think the biggest one that's happening across our country is homelessness, and that that gets paintbrushed, if you will, as far as one person, when really there's many different persons involved in that group. And homelessness is not a crime, and there are people that are in need of assistance, but also intertwined there are people that are creating low-level crimes and misdemeanors and basically nuisance type crimes that affect the population. And so what happens is everybody gets paintbrushed by the few. And so I spend a lot of time trying to talk about that, that, you know, some of our homeless veterans or homeless folks that, you know, truly are in need of services and stuff are intermixed in a group where we see sometimes the vagrants creating, you know, low-level crime, and have to make sure that people are aware those are separate entities, even though they may look as one. So I spent a lot of time on that, I guess you could say. It's also why we started a sobering center in Grants Pass to kind of address some of the, and not make everything criminal by taking people to jail, but look at an alternative for, you know, helping that demographic.
That's been over about 3 years now, 2 or 3 years?
2 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And how's it working for you?
Oh, phenomenal. I mean, it's amazing what we've been able to do. And, you know, it's an intervention. It's not, you know, it's an ability for someone to make a change and also not to have to run them through the criminal justice system because of, you know, being under the influence.
And Josephine County has drug court, too. I mean,
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that probably helps as well. Let's come back for a final time to the white supremacy discussion. Recommendations to the public. If people do see posters, I mean, what are the kinds of things that they should do? Should they contact Grants Pass Public Safety, for example, as a first recourse, or what's the best set of options here?
Yeah, always contact your local law enforcement to report, you know, what you're seeing. It makes us aware, and we'll start to look into it to see whether or not there's, you know, some actual threats, and then also sometimes to meet with the groups or the individuals to see, you know, what's going on. So yeah, always contact your law enforcement agency.
Some of the responses have been interesting. I noticed that if you look at the website that purports to be the site of True Cascadia, there's also a website with a very, very similar name that has used all the same imagery and iconography and basically just fonts. I mean, just turned the whole thing back completely on its head.
Yeah, and that's what I say. A lot of these groups become spinoffs where they cut and paste from another group, and so you're trying to figure out, you know, who they really are, who they actually are.
So how much monitoring or do you have to do at Grants Pass Public Safety to know who might be out there?
So we do, like with any group, any potential criminal group that would, you know, cause harm to our citizens and stuff, we basically need to monitor to see what, you know, they're about and what they're doing. We don't ongoing monitor groups, but when we start to see hate and things like that that could rise to the level of intimidation, which, you know, basically the law protects citizens from, we need to start monitoring that and get ahead of it. So
Have things been fairly quiet since the most recent spate of posters in October?
Yes. We haven't seen anything come of that, so that's been good.
All right. Best of luck with that. Bill Landis is the public safety chief in Grants Pass. Thanks for making the trip down to Ashland to talk to us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great. Thanks for having me.